Mother, read by or written by P.D. Eastman. Let me share with you a summary of that little book as I printed it off here to remind you of what that book is about. There was this little bird that had been born, and the book goes something like this. A mother bird sat on her egg. The egg jumped. I must get something for my baby bird to eat, she said, and then she flew away. Inside the nest, the egg jumped. It jumped and it jumped and it jumped until out came a baby bird. Where is my mother? He said. He did not see her anywhere. I will go and look for her, he said. Well, out of the nest he went. Down, 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 plop. The baby bird could not fly. But amazingly, he could walk. Now I will go and find my mother, he said. Are you my mother? The baby bird asked a kitten. The kitten just looked and looked. It did not say a thing. Amazingly, that kitten did not eat that little bird. Are you my mother? The baby bird asked a hen. No, said the hen. Are you my mother? The baby bird asked a dog. I am not your mother. I am a dog, said the dog. Are you my mother? The baby bird asked a cow. How could I be your mother? Said the cow. I am a cow. The baby bird stopped to think. The kitten and the hen were not my mother. The dog and the cow were not my mother. I have a mother, said the baby bird. I know I do. I will find her. I will. Just then the baby bird saw a big thing. It's a big crane, basically. Are you my mother? He said. The big thing said, snort. Oh, no, said the baby bird. You are a big, hairy snort. Scary snort. The snort then lifted the baby bird up. Up and up. Then something happened. The snort put the baby bird right back in the tree. The baby bird was home. Just then, the baby bird's mother came back. I know who you are, the baby bird said. You are not a kitten, or a hen, or a dog, or a cow, or a snort. You are a bird. And you are my mother. A sweet little book that we would read to our kids, just reminding them of the love of a mother and how nobody can replace a mother. Well, in many ways, today's passage deals with the same subject. As Jesus was asked about his mother and his brothers, and then Jesus asked this question, well, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? I want us to look at Mark chapter 3, verse 31 through 35. Let me read the entirety of the text, and I want to walk back through that passage and explain what Jesus is really driving at. In Mark chapter 3, starting in verse 31, and his mother and his brothers came. Jesus was in a house teaching. And his mother and brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you. And he answered them, who are my mother and my brothers? And looking about at those who sat around him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. Jesus is taking an opportunity to do some deeper teaching here. In no way do I find this passage being discarding of the family. In no way do I think Jesus is driving home the point that families are unimportant or should be devalued in any way. Here his mother and his brothers are outside speaking in, trying to get his attention, but he then points to the higher value of the eternal family of God in a relationship with God the Father. See, throughout the scriptures, we know that the value of a family, because God is the one who ordained and established the family. Even in the top 10 commandments, it was stated that thou shalt honor your father and your mother, and your days will be very long. Back in Exodus chapter 20. In just a few chapters in the book of Mark, chapter 7, Jesus is confronting the Pharisees on the commandments of God versus just the men's traditions. And he said in chapter 7, verse 9, you have a fine way of rejecting the command of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother. And whoever reviles father and mother must certainly or surely die. So Jesus in no way devalues the family. In fact, Paul picks up on this theme later in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8. He says, but if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially the members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So throughout the scriptures, Genesis to Revelation, the family is held high. The family is to be honored. The family is to be protected and provided for. So as we look at this passage in Mark 31, chapter 3, verse 31, we're not seeing here Jesus saying brothers and sisters and mothers are of no value. But he's putting a contrast between how much we value our earthly family versus how much we value the eternal relationship with our Heavenly Father in the family of God. You know, consider this. If a mom and dad decide one evening to go out, it's non-COVID days, and you can go out to a restaurant and enjoy yourself, and mom and dad say, hey, we're going to go out this evening. We've got smaller children, so we're going to get a babysitter. And as the babysitter comes over, that babysitter has all authority to be with those children, to direct their time together, to send them to bed at the time that's appropriate according to the parents' wishes, and so the parents can go out and have a wonderful time. If that babysitter chooses to violate the parents' wishes, say the babysitter decides, hey, we're gonna watch movies your parents would never allow you to watch. We're going to eat all the ice cream and cake and sugar that we can have. I know your mom and dad wouldn't appreciate this, but I'm the cool babysitter. I'm going to allow you to do that. The kids have to decide, do we honor the authority of the babysitter or the higher authority of mom and dad, who are actually the ones who are responsible for us? Now, I want you to consider this. Every mom and dad who have children are those who've been put in authority. But there is a higher authority. There is a higher relationship that we honor, respect, surrender to, and that's our eternal Father. And so in this, it's not about whether the mom and the dad, the brothers, are of value. But in contrast, there's a greater value. Someone higher in our thoughts, higher in our allegiance in comparison. Our earthly relationships are of value, but our eternal relationship with the Father is far more significant. And Jesus is using this opportunity to highlight this, to find where your commitments truly are. You know, it's interesting. Jesus used some other passages to really show the distinction between an earthly relationship and an eternal relationship. In the chapter, Luke chapter 14, verse 26, he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. That's a startling statement. But when you understand it in the context of the value of earthly relationships, but how much more valuable an essential, a heavenly, eternal relationship is with the Father, you understand when his word hate here is in comparison to, it almost seems like hating them. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 37, in a more extended teaching on this important relationship with God, he says, whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Jesus never calls us to stop loving, to stop serving our earthly families. But he says it should not stop there. God is not one of many that you should love. God is the ultimate, the supreme, the highest love. For if you love him well, from his love that overflows in you, you'll be able to love others in an appropriate fashion. Even in Luke chapter 20, there was debate about individual that is married, and if they were to die on, and that person were even to marry other people, who will be married in heaven? Who is your spouse in heaven? Jesus was very clear in this teaching that there is no giving of marriage. We're not married in heaven to one another. That we collectively, if you look throughout the scriptures and even in Revelation, it's not that we're married to one another in heaven. It's not that type of relationship. We collectively are the bride of Christ, and we're married to him. And so in heaven, in our eternal relationship is far different than our earthly relationships. And Jesus puts the emphasis on that right here in this short passage. There are a few words that I'm going to take from the text that I think will set a good outline, understanding what it really means to be a disciple. Someone who is a follower of Christ. And in comparison to all other relationships, how is Jesus in our life set apart, separate, holy, distinct from everything else? I'm going to use three words. I'm going to use the word standing, seeking, and then I'm going to insert the word serving or even surrendering. I think these three words uniquely and distinctively set our passage in a unique way for us today to understand what Jesus is driving at. Standing is our first word. In verse 31, it says very clearly, and his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. Metaphorically, Jesus's mom and brothers are standing outside the house wanting to get in to get his attention. But I want to just say metaphorically, illustratively, it represents every person who is not a true follower of Christ. I explained last week about his brother James. James did not follow Jesus. He didn't surrender to him. He didn't believe in him as the Son of God and the Messiah who had been sent. And so he, along with his mother and brothers, are standing, and perhaps even his sisters are standing outside this house, are representative of every person in the world without a relationship with Jesus. They are outside the family of God. You might be peering in to look. You might be wanting to get his attention, but you're not following. You're not surrendering to him. You don't really care about who he is other than what he's doing has your attention, but you're outside. Realize that every person born in this world is outside the family of God. You might be a creation of God, but you're not a child of God. You're outside of that relationship. Something distinct and unique has to happen in your life. It's called the adoption of the children of God, that God does something in and through you to adopt you into his family. But in and of yourself, you are separated from the holiness of God, the relationship with God, and what separates us is sin. We're all born with sin. Every person, every mother watching this today, as precious as their child was, and as that child was born and they held him, oh, they loved that child. Same with God, he loves you. Sin separates us, and it doesn't take very long for a parent to realize there is sin embedded into the child that they've been given. Romans chapter 3, verse 23 says it very clearly. For all, A-L-L, have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Because of that, we are separated. We are outside the relationship and the family of God. And they are sitting here outside, and it makes me think, well, what does it mean to be inside? How can we be inside the family of God? Well, Jesus certainly is drawing a distinction here in this passage that being related physically by blood does not make you a member of the family of God. As he thinks about his mother and his brothers and his sister outside, it's not the family relationship that puts you inside the family of God. So your mother cannot save you. Your grandmother who prays for you isn't the one able to make you a part of the family of God. your father, your distant cousin who's a preacher. You get no credit for any of this. Physical relationship does not make you an eternal relationship with God in the family of God. There's no guarantee that just because somebody in your family is a believer in Christ, it doesn't guarantee that you'll have an eternal relationship with God. It is a specific surrendering of yourself to God that puts that reality on you. So physical relationship is not part of the eternal relationship with God. Neither is position or influence opening the door for you. You might ask, well, don't you know who I am? You know, over the last year, it's been fascinating to watch either politicians or famous people in the entertainment industry who get pulled over for speeding or doing something else in violation of the law. And the police officer will come up, and I love the camera effect where you get to watch their faces of these individuals. And as they're writing the citation, the person will no doubt say, well, don't you know who I am? As if the position they have or the influence they have should eliminate any responsibility of their sin. And I love when the officers are very direct with them and say, yes, I know who you are. You're the person who broke the law, and I'm actually going to get your autograph right here on this ticket. When it comes to the eternal relationship with God, your position, your amount of influence on this earthly planet will have no value, will have no distinction in the eternity with God. It doesn't matter what you've done on this earth. It doesn't matter who you've impacted. You have to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Who is my mother and who are my brothers? It's not physical relationship. It's not your positions or anything that you have done. Neither is it the amount of money or possessions that will qualify you. I don't care if you have $1 billion right now. And certainly people with money have some influence in this world. There's non-scientists. If they have enough money, they can influence the World Health Organization. But there's no amount of money that will influence God to change His holy standards of what it means to have a relationship with Him. You can't buy your way into heaven. Neither can you take any of your possessions with you to the other side. So considering, if it's not physical relationship, if it's not positions, if it's not all your possessions and money, well, what is it? Well, I want us to go to the next word. If it's not, if you're standing, you're only standing outside the family of God, well, then there's the word seeking. And I want you to notice this in the text in verse 32. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, well, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you. And he answered them, who are my mother and brothers? You know, in our world, we sometimes use the word seeking. Oh, people are seeking for God. People are seeking for hope, seeking for answers. And those are good and necessary things. But seeking isn't all equal. Why were the family members of Jesus seeking him? Was it because they wanted to be concerned about him? Were they seeking his counsel? Were they seeking to help his ministry? There's no evidence of that whatsoever. They were seeking him. It reminds me of the time Jesus was 12 years old. Joseph and Mary and the family and many of the relatives and acquaintances had traveled into Jerusalem because of the Passover feast. And they had celebrated for several days in the Passover. And then as Passover concluded, they all packed up their gear and they began to move out. Somewhere along the way, Joseph must have looked over at Mary and said, hey, have you seen Jesus? And she said something to the effect of, well, I thought you had him. And Joseph, no, I thought you had him. And they looked around and they talked to the various people with them, and nobody could find Jesus. Have you ever been like that, by the way? I know there have been an occasion or two in the time I've been a pastor where a family will come back looking for a child that had been left because the one parent thought the other parent had them, and both of them got home and realized, no, that child had been left behind. Well, as they discovered that Jesus was no longer with their traveling crew, they turned around and went back to Jerusalem. And there was still a lot of activity in town, and it took them 3 days to find Jesus. Of course, they were perturbed. They found him, and he wasn't just wandering around hanging out with a bad crowd. He was actually sitting there among the teachers, asking questions and also giving profound answers. As Joseph and Mary walked up to him, Mary said to him, you know, what have you been doing? Why are you here? And Jesus answered, though direct, he was very respectful. Jesus said to her, why were you looking for me? It's a great question. Why do you look for Jesus? Why are you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house? See, Jesus, even at 12 years old, was showing, my family is important, but I have a higher calling. That I serve an eternal Father who has a calling on my life and has called me out to do things that may go beyond the limitations of my earthly family. To show you that he still respected his mom and dad, he left with them. He surrendered to them, and he went about their way honoring whatever they were wanting him to do. But even here, and as Mary watched, it says in the passage that she treasured these things in her heart. She had a respectful son, but she realized that she could not contain him based on her own earthly parameters, that Jesus had to step out of that sheltering to serve a greater purpose. You realize in your earthly family, of as much value as they are, there's a higher calling and there's an eternal Father that has much more for you. And that every mom and dad ought to ultimately surrender their will to the Father and pray that their child will not be limited by the earthly standards that we can set, but they'll be called to a higher calling of what God will do in and through them. That's a great, great blessing when you can see your own children grow far beyond what you can give them, because the Spirit of God has a calling in their life and draws them closer to himself and sets them up high for God's honor and glory. In this passage, as he was 12 years old, he was already seeking the Father's will. And so the other question I have beyond, you know, why were Jesus' family members seeking him here in this passage in Mark chapter 3? Were they really concerned about him? Were they really wanting to surrender to him? There's no evidence of that. Just look up a few verses earlier in verse 21 when it says that his family heard that he was there, that they wanted to seize him, and they were saying, he is out of his mind. His brothers were proclaiming that he is crazy. So this certainly indicates that just a few verses later, as they're now outside the house saying, hey, Jesus, come out, they're not wanting to help him. They're wanting to hinder him. They're wanting to pull him away. Stop talking the craziness you're talking. Stop trying to influence these people. Just come back to our social family parameters. That's all we want you to do. You're embarrassing to us. So that's why Jesus knew about seeking. They weren't seeking him for him. They were seeking him for themselves, to protect themselves from any more harassment or embarrassment in the culture that they were experiencing. It makes me think about people seeking in our day. Why do people seek God? Why do people seek Jesus? Why do people seek a higher power or hope beyond themselves? What is it that prompts people to seek? Well, there's different reasons why people seek God or Jesus specifically. Some truly are empty and desiring to know that there's a true God. They're curious. They're curious to know if what he says is true and if what he does truly does take place. And as people were seeking Jesus in Jesus' day, as well as today, they truly want to know and they truly want to grow in him. But there are some who seek Jesus not for Jesus. They seek Jesus for their own blessing, perhaps their own gain. You know, about a year and a half ago, my garage door busted. The springs had busted, really challenging. You couldn't lift your garage door open. So I needed help outside of myself. I got on the phone. I called a company. A man came over, and he fixed our garage. I was so thankful for him. I paid him the fee that was required. But, you know, I don't want a relationship with him. I didn't get his cell phone number, and we don't hang out. You know, I don't call him once in a while, see how he's doing. I don't even remember the guy's name. because it didn't matter to me. Certainly he's of value in God's sight, but our relationship was just simply an exchange. I have a need, you can meet my need. When the need is met, you can go about your way. And quite frankly, there are some that treat God in the same fashion. People don't seek God always for God. They seek God for the benefit, blessing, or gain they can receive from him. We see this even in the New Testament. There were people who were crippled, people who were lame, people who had a physical need. Maybe they were hungry. They would go to Jesus, have their need met, be thankful, and then they go about their way, never desiring a relationship or a further interaction with Jesus. Remember the 10 lepers. 10 of them were healed, but only one came back to thank him. Only one wanted to extend that relationship. So there are many people who are curious, and they are seeking Jesus. Some because they want to know him and grow with him, and some simply because they just want to gain from him and go about their way. I know there are some who, throughout their history, maybe something was difficult in their life. They've lost a loved one. They've had a transition in their job. They've just had some kind of difficulty. And so in that time of need, they went to church. They prayed to God. They said, if you'll just meet my need, I'll just give you everything. And God blesses them. They give them common grace, and he meets their need. But then weeks, months, years later, there's been no interaction with God. There's not been no heart longing or seeking him. They went to him for a transaction, not for transformation. But we know that other people seek God not because they're curious, some of them because they're critical. We've been seeing throughout the book of Mark, Pharisees and scribes and the religious leaders who went to him, seeking him, looking to see what he would do, because they were critical, not curious. They felt threatened, or quite frankly, they were tyrannical. They thought, we're the authority, you are not, you need to stay in your place, you need to be removed or exterminated because we are at the top and we're not having any more room for anybody else. So that some people seek Jesus because they're curious. Some people seek Jesus just because they're critical. But Jesus is really driving home the fact it's not the seeking that's wrong, it's the why you seek. You know, he's looking for people who have a heart for him. The seekers who will be committed. The seekers who will be surrendered. The seekers who truly want to know that God is majestic and holy and set apart, unlike anything or anyone else in this world. And when we recognize his beauty, his majesty, we will give him our full allegiance. We do all that we can. When we find that he is a treasure worth giving everything else up for, even our own lives would be surrendered to him. That leads me to the last word. The word I've selected is serving, but I think I'd even extend that word to surrendering. It's not about what we do. It's about who we follow, truly, that we give everything to him. You look at the last two verses here in this chapter, and looking about at those who sat around him, and there was an extended crowd there. There were his disciples, and you can see their names just in a few verses before this section. But there was Pharisees who were critical. There were other people who just wanted to be healed. But looking at his disciples and those who had surrendered their life to him, willing to go wherever he leads, this is the crowd he's looking at. And he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and my sister and my mother. These are the ones who are converted. These are the ones who are committed. These are the ones who are the true children of God. See, it's not about physical family relationships. It's not about your finances or your positions. It's truly about, have you converted to follow Christ, turning your heart over to him? Have you fully committed your life to him? That's a child of God. It says here that those who do the will of God. You know, so it's not about doing, and this is why I know this. Jesus said, some people come to him and say, hey, don't you see? We've done this and we've done that and we've done that. Don't you know us? And Jesus said to them, depart from me. I never knew you. It wasn't about what they were doing, because anything that's doing apart from the full relationship with Jesus is just noise. You know, 1 Corinthians chapter 13 talks about love. You know, if I do this and I do this, even if I burn my body but have not love, it's a noisy gong, a clinging cymbal. Here, Jesus is not calling us to do more to be accepted into his family. Doing the will of God is in surrendering to him so that he will do his will through us. His will is that you would just accept him for who he is. Believe in Jesus and the power of his resurrection. That you would surrender your will, get off your throne, and bow to the one who has done it all for you. And in response to what he has done for us, his Spirit will live in us and begin to change us from the inside out. His will is done when we surrender to his will. Not my will, but God's will. You know, there's nothing greater than living out the will of God. Even a book that I was reading this week was impressing upon me once again that me trying harder will not be the solution to transformation. But me surrendering to what he is doing, to look around and see where he is working and joining him. Not that I would stir within myself all these things, say, God, look at what I'm doing, because God's not impressed with what we're doing. God's impressed when we just surrender and we get impressed with him. Who are my mother? Who are my brothers and my sisters? Those who do the will of God. Those who surrender their lives and serve by just following Jesus and being content in him alone. Now, I've mentioned that James, his brother, wasn't following him. Neither were any of his other brothers or sisters. But I'm thankful that though this passage, it seems to be a separation. After the resurrection of Christ, there was a unity, a unitedness, not based on physical relationship, not based on the blood of the family, but based on the blood of Christ that brought them into the family. I mentioned that James not only came to Christ, well, actually, Christ, after the resurrection, came to James, and then James surrendered his life to Jesus and became the pastor of the first church in Jerusalem. But in Acts chapter 1, verse 14, it says, all these, with one accord, were devoting themselves to prayer together with the women and the mother of Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. Every one of Jesus' family members who were opposed to him prior to the death and resurrection had begun to surrender their lives and follow him, and not just treat him as a physical brother, but they were an eternal spiritual brother with Jesus, worshiping the same heavenly Father. I think that's a beautiful passage. See, in your own family, as committed as you may be to your physical family, which you ought to be, you ought to honor your mother and your father. You ought to love and pray for your brothers and sisters. But when there's spiritual difference, never neglect serving them, but continue to serve your heavenly Father and see what God will do through your life to unite your siblings around the same throne of Jesus. Praying for that. Now, the question I have for you today is, where are you standing, and where are you seeking, and where are you serving? Are you standing in the power of God because you have surrendered your life to him? Or are you still standing outside the faith, peering in, looking in, but not a part of the family? Are you seeking and seeking Jesus for Jesus? When I get to heaven, what do I want? I want to be with God because he's the one that I worship. Are you seeking Jesus for just what he can do for you? Are you seeking him for him alone? And are you serving him? Are you surrendered to him? Have you submitted your life to him? This is what God's call and will is for our lives. I think every one of us today could respond in some way maybe recommit our lives to Him, or just thank Him for what He's doing for us and through us, and still praying, not my will, but Your will be done. But I know there are some who watch every week who've never surrendered their life to Jesus. And today He's calling you to do so. So that He doesn't look out and say, who are my mother and my brothers? But He can look right at you and know, you're my brother, you're my mother, you're my sister. We're part of the same family. If you'll respond in some way to Jesus, I'm going to ask that you go to a website, www.respond.faith. Let us know of your commitment. Let us know how we can be praying for you.